variants of the same story. Good beats evil, cowboys and Indians, profits and loss. This story has been told 1,000,000,000 times, and the ubiquity of it is what I would call a great tragedy. A tragedy because of the consequence it's had on our imagination and our relationships. The Brilliant Podcast is an attempt to tell different kinds of stories. Ones with complex moral plays, ones that aren't so clearly stories, and ones that are of human size. Our motivation to tell these tales is a desire to see proliferation of different stories, and not just the simple morality plays of popular culture, or the inverted, but otherwise identical, stories of the radical milieu. We believe the world of free people is possible. We call these people the people who are in active pursuit of a free world, the brilliant, because they are impossible to ignore and cannot be seen directly, especially in a world that is dull and gray. I'm your host, Eric Horn, joined by your co-host, Bellamy. This week, our theme is Anarchist Principles, and we begin.
And one day I came in, and a woman who had lost a child was talking to a robot in the shape of a baby seal. It seemed to be looking in her eyes. It seemed to be following the conversation. It comforted her. And many people found this amazing.
So I'm going to talk to you about you and how you can be brilliant every single day.
Welcome to another episode of Brilliant. This is our third one. This is September 11th, an important day in history. Actually, at some point I should tell the...
It's called Patriots Day.
Patriots Day, yeah. At some point I should talk about the Bay Area reaction to Patriots Day, because if it isn't recorded or somehow written down at some point, we're going to lose that memory. But basically, September 11th, 2001... in the Bay Area, as soon as the event happened, a phone tree sort of lit up, and sort of everyone knew was invited to sort of sit down and talk about, like, what is the radical response to 9/11. And, you know, this was still early days, but by the time that we all sat down together, which was in the evening, there were at least 100 or more people in the room, but it was a lot of different factions, definitely factions that did not like each other, were all in the room together, including the reading group being sort of one of those larger factions. And, you know, the evening went on and on. It was a muddled mess of sort of what people's motivations were and what they wanted to talk about. And the moderator was Bo Brown. Do you know who Bo Brown is?
No, I don't.
Bo Brown was part of the George Jackson Brigade.
Okay.
So absolutely this important figure in anarchist history, because the George Jackson Brigade was both Marxists and anarchists.
Right.
And Bo Brown was part of the anarchist faction. And Bo has been like a sort of solid figure in the queer world for forever. She's a stone cold Butch Dyke.
Uh-huh.
And she was a horrible moderator. You know, she absolutely had her own sort of mission that she wanted to accomplish in the event, which probably looked like something that we'd call activism. People talked crazy. They talked about anarchists defending mosques.
Wow.
They talked about anarchists defending party stores owned by Muslims. And finally, this young Latina woman came in and said, you know, I have a statement that I'd like to read from my group, which I believe was Soul. It might have been Storm. I can't. The acronyms get a little confusing because I don't exactly understand who's who in this. But basically, this is a group of primarily people of color. It's a Maoist group that sort of did people's education work, but absolutely had a Maoist pedigree. And so, as you can imagine, what they had to say about the day's events was doctrinaire.
Well, I mean, just the formality of, here's a written statement from my group.
Yeah.
I mean, it already speaks volumes, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so she started going on and on and on. But of course, everybody was being respectful, and probably she was on the verge of wrapping it up, and so we could move on. And Kevin Keating stood up.
Okay.
Kevin Keating exists in real life. He stood up and basically said, "How much fucking longer am I going to have to listen to this shit?"
And as you
I'm guessing things started to unravel at that point.
I mean, they never raveled again, for sure. I mean, that was the end of the evening, but it basically...
It takes September 11th to get all the radicals in a room together. After an hour or two, they realize they don't like each other.
Yeah, it was shocking. But the amazing part of it was sort of like some of the things that people said in this moment. Like explicitly, people stood up and basically shouted like racist and like just everything. And so it was really like this, like, how can you make people hate you the fastest? You know, the most interrupt a young Latino woman obviously ranks pretty high. And then Lawrence also, and this is sort of that one of these amazing moments where Lawrence spoke up and sort of repeated what Kevin said, kind of to back him up. But if anything, the entire target of the ire of the evening was on Lawrence. Like, Lawrence is the one who really carried the burden of that day, which, of course, maybe in later episodes we'll talk about other similar types of stories. Yeah. But
so even though he tried to be more reasonable in the way that he was...
Vaguely more reasonable. I mean, I think actually he wasn't reasonable. I mean, but more or less repeated the spirit of what Kevin was trying to say, which was perhaps this is not the moment.
A bunch of doctrinaire nonsense, and I'm an anarchist, and I don't.
Exactly. Yeah. Anyway, so this week, in terms of our news segment, we're going to talk about the Change Everything tour that was announced this week from CrimeThink. They're going to go on a 2-month national tour. And we're going to talk about that. And we're also going to talk about the topic of the week that happened on Anarchist News this week, which was on aging. Mm-hmm. But first up, the CrimeThink to Change Everything tour. And we're not going to talk so much about the document itself, because perhaps that's work for another episode. The main question, or the main sort of thought I have, is this idea of a U.S. tour. You know, they're kind of doing... Pretty much every radical space that I know of in North America, or especially on the U.S. side. And I guess the thing that I sort of want to speak to is the fact that one of the promises of the To Change Everything document was to break out mm-hmm. of the milieu.
Yeah.
A lot of different tendencies, a lot of different people are talking about, you know, what does it mean to talk to regular people? And To Change Everything as a document, much more than Fighting for Our Life, is this document that really strips the sort of personalities of radical politics out of the equation and tries to make a case for radical politics by other names, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah.
Well, I was going to say, it's kind of interesting. And I know CrimeThink, I don't know if they still hold to this. I know at one point they had this sort of stance against citation as this residue of academia. And so often you can see with CrimeThink documents, them sort of going through and you can kind of in your head name the names and say, like, oh, they're talking Kropotkin right now, they're talking Stirner now. And you can very much see that in this document. And the way it reads it, it sort of tries to hit all the bullet points, I think, of prominent anarchist thinkers without naming them and put them in this more approachable and accessible way that actually, to me, sort of muddies things, because I think within this document you can find internal contradictions. And I wonder... Is this their attempt to sort of reach as many people as possible by, you know, saying something that everyone can latch onto?
Well, let's come back to the contradictions later, because I definitely would love to hear your thoughts on mm-hmm. what is the
sure.
what are some of those contradictions.
Sure.
But this document does come out of a perceived need that Fighting for Our Life, you know, which I think they altogether published maybe 250,000 copies or something. Maybe it was even 500,000. It was an awful lot. And
it's actually
and,
quite amazing.
No, it's yeah. incredible. Yeah, absolutely. Especially for a free document.
Yeah.
And so 10 years later, basically after publishing that document, they felt the need to sort of do it again. And my guess is that now their finances are more constrained than they were 10 years ago, because mm-hmm. they haven't exactly done any bestsellers in the past 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so the desire for this document absolutely came out of the same desire as Fighting for a Life, which is sort of how do you introduce a new generation to these ideas? And 2 or 3 years ago, you know, the core brain trust of CrimeThink is based in North Carolina. And they have a book fair there in Carrboro on, it's in the late fall. And a couple years ago, they basically announced as part of the book fair a contest for people to sort of write new introductions to anarchism. So, in other words, sort of like...
like an Anarchy 101.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And one of the prominent entries into the contest was Life Without Law, which is... which is Magpie's, Margaret Killjoy's attempt to sort of do an anarchist introduction. And so so that's the terrain in which this document came out of. But this document, my guess is that they were writing it for years. Mm-hmm. And there definitely was a large collective process around it. I don't know very many details about it. But for me, the overriding feel that I get out of that document is that a committee wrote it.
Yeah, definitely.
And so it really has the weaknesses of what it looks like when a committee writes a document. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure if it's by their measure, perhaps in every sort of question.
So look, episodes 2, 3, and 4 were recorded while I was away, so we didn't realize that the mic connection was destroying portions of the recordings until I got back and started working on putting the episodes together. So episode 4 will have some glitches as well, but from episode 5 on, this will no longer be a feature of the show. Thanks for bearing with us while we figure out how to make a podcast. But during the glitchy part that I cut out, Aragorn said that a significant difference between Fighting for Our Lives and To Change Everything is that in the years following its release, Fighting for Our Lives was in every, quote, radical bathroom. People were talking about it. It was memorable. And To Change Everything, not so much. He said that he had to go dig a copy of To Change Everything out of the LBC distro because no one he lives with had a copy on hand. Then he mentions the North Carolina Book Fair Anarchist Primer Contest because it was a mine from which to get raw material that could be put into To Change Everything, and says that one of the best documents to come out of the book fair contest was Life Without LOL, LOL. And that this document claims that in the modern anarchist space, there are basically 4 aspects of modern anarchism that make up that space, one of which is queer nihilism. And an essential identifying feature of queer nihilists is a wet butt. That wet butts equals queer nihilism, and that this is unforgettable. Bellamy said that he had to reread To Change Everything before recording because he had read it when it first came out and he couldn't remember any of it. For Aragorn, what was most memorable about To Change Everything was the preponderance of shockingly cliché leftist imagery, like Tiananmen Square, etc. Anyway, here they are discussing said imagery.
And, you know, that's just jaw-dropping, yeah. Especially with Prime Thing, who always do such a fantastic job of visual design, sort of to return to these...
I mean, old images.
Yeah. I mean, the baby hugging the tree...
Yeah, well, you know, I had the hardest time with that one.
Yeah, brutal. Really brutal. And it just, I mean, I guess it speaks to the fact that they're attempting to invite strangers into a conversation.
But yeah, the Black Power image, I mean, that's just strange. I mean, at best, it seems patronizing. At worst, it seems appropriative.
Yeah, I don't really know. The thing for me is their goal a reasonable middle-aged person that listens to NPR who might be interested in radical ideas, or is their goal the youth?
Right.
In the past, the thing that they've always done very well is they've been the starter kit for radicals, and perhaps they're acknowledging something that might be true, which is that it's more likely that an older person is going to find anarchism interesting and worth exploring, rather than younger people who sort of, you know, I can't imagine a young person looking at many of those images and relating. Like, they might not even have ever seen the Black Power.
That's true.
The same thing before.
Yeah, I mean, right before we started recording, I said that the best way that I can read the piece, and I mean this generously, is that I could imagine my mother picking it up and finding it completely approachable. And my mother, just to give a little background, is Midwestern, second-generation American, suburbanite woman, listens to NPR, pretty gender normative in a lot of ways. And I can imagine her picking that up and not finding anything that's difficult to approach. And so if in fact, it is aimed at the older crowd, middle America, sure. I mean,
Yeah, and that
there are no strange names. There's no academic pretension.
So they're going on this U.S. tour. Obviously, they're going to be speaking about the piece. But my guess, and this is sort of the experience that, of Crime Think in general. In general, when they do face to face or crowd work, they usually walk entirely off text. And then the main thing that they attempt to accomplish is some sort of performative sort of task. And so that's going to be interesting to see what it is that they do. And in particular, here in the Bay Area, they're going to do three different events.
Oh, wow.
They're going to do an event in the city that's probably going to be a sort of big popular sort of thing, like at a big hall or whatever. Mm-hmm. They're going to do a thing at the Omni, of course, which is going to be their East Bay fundraising sort of side. And finally, they're going to actually come to our reading group, which meets in Berkeley on Tuesdays. And they say that what we're going to get in Tuesday is going to be utterly different and that they're sort of expecting a critical engagement on Tuesday. And I somewhat suspect that perhaps my guess is that there are going to be two carloads of people. And my guess is we're going to get half of that carload for the long haul. But I look forward to going to probably to the Omni event. Just to see, you know, how the breaks happen and you know, what does it look like when they're, you know, winking?
Are they playing politics?
Yeah.
I notice they're significantly not going to Quilombo.
Right, sure. Oh, I'm sure they wouldn't even be invited.
Mm-hmm.
And that there'd be a big meeting about it.
Yeah. if they were invited.
Well, be a big either way, yeah.
Probably shut it down.
Okay. Why don't we move on to talking about this piece?
I wanted to just touch on one thing with the rhetoric. You said the contradictions.
Right.
Yeah, the one thing I'll highlight, I don't want to dwell on the text too much, especially since I could see us talking about this in more detail when they come. But to me, it was very significant that they begin the piece by saying anarchism is the idea that everyone is entitled to complete self-determination, which I think, as we were talking about in the first episodes of this, to me is a very Western idea of freedom. And it's sort of the autonomous individual or the kind of liberal idea of the individual. And then they go on later to talk over and over about how we're not really individuals and we're freedom is more a matter of relations than it is individuality. And it just seemed kind of odd to me to hold both of that. And then at the end, they talk about self-determination again. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure one could deconstruct this and say self-determination isn't really about that idea. But to me, rhetorically, if you're writing to America, that is what people think of. I'm my own sovereign.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, yeah, I don't want to dive too much into the text itself. Crime Think does do this thing, but it's not just Crime Think. Crime Think is interesting in this way, culturally. It's sort of both coastal and Midwestern. Mm. And a lot of the people who do the writing and the thinking around Crime Think are the Midwesterners. Mm. And it's hard to, like, is North Carolina the East Coast? Well, of course it is, but it's not culturally the East Coast.
No,
it's not the arc between DC and New York.
Right.
But that said, the topic that you're talking about does feel very Midwestern to me, because a Midwesterner in general is going to say that everything can be everything, that you don't necessarily have to have these hard breaks and contradictory sort of lines. So they're going to say, yeah, you can absolutely be a self-determined individual and there's no
a set of relations. Sure. Mm-hmm.
And
my analytic philosophy mind is, cowering that kind of plurality.
No, I mean, one of the things I always remark on when I go to the Midwest is like the phenomena that I see all the time where you'll have a kid who will come to an event and they'll be wearing a slingshot t-shirt, an IWW hat, and an Earth First patch. And you're just like, I did die, but basically what they're trying to present it with that image is like, I'm here. Like, I'm ready.
I'm for it.
I'm for good things. I'm probably against bad things.
Yeah.
And your whole, West Coast attitude about it doesn't matter to me.
Sure.
Which for me, of course, is highly irritating. I Topic of the week, anarchist aging and burnout. Yeah, so basically this is Anarchist News provided a very brief sketch on the fact that anarchists and aging is a thing, but the thread has been explosive. I mean, it's still has a couple days on it, and it's well over 200 comments, and at least the first 100 were really good, really good conversation. A lot of people who clearly, like, are older and are experiencing that.
Yeah, actually, it was pretty awesome to see so many people come out of the woodwork, and it's, some of it I find relatable, some of it I find unrelatable, but I think it was great that a lot of people were eager to kind of tell a story and say, I'm this old, this is what happened to me. And it's very interesting for me as a young person, not only young in general, but also very new to actually spending time around anarchists. And I've thought for years that one of the most toxic things about the dominant culture is that people tend to spend the vast majority of their time around people their own age, unless it's their immediate nuclear family. So in growing up as a kid, you're in a peer age group. The only people who are different ages are these more or less distant authority figures in school. And then a lot of people, once they take a job that they keep for a part or most of their life, are still spending time around people their age. And I think it's cliche to say, but absolutely true, that for not around older people, I think there's a huge loss of transmission of wisdom. There's a loss of humility with knowing what you're doing. And when you're not around younger people, I think there's a loss of a sense of play and spontaneity. And so, I mean, the fact that we don't have, I think one of the complaints I saw sort of rising to the surface among different comments was the fact we don't have stable anarchist spaces that are multi-generational. Or we have very few.
Well, it's hard to imagine what one would look like. I mean, you know, currently we're in this active conflict around at the Long Haul, to our local info shop. And the fact that we can actually even have a generation, and at the heart of that conflict is a generational sort of shift. Mm-hmm. Even though I happen to be the same generation as sort of the old guard that's attempting to preserve a certain sort of style at the Long Haul. My heart is with the new guard that's sort of just trying to change things in general without necessarily a clear vision of what that change would look like, other than desiring a change. And watching that generational shift happen, I mean, one of the things that the older people really bring up sort of all the time is, like, you know, we're real. We have this thing that we've been trying to do for forever, and we want help. Mm-hmm. But what they don't sort of recognize in their own statements is that they want help doing the thing that they want to be done, right, rather than we want to see this radical space transform and change as it's appropriate to do. Because the problem with the older people is that there isn't a group of people in their mid-40s who are, you know, talking about the good old days of Gilman Street. And there's a totally new generation of people who want to talk about entirely different things that are, yeah, just different, and aren't as punk rock focused, as an example. But the that's actually my main criticism of the thread of this piece in particular, is that there's lots of complaining, like definitely some perceptive older people who are sort of really naming some age appropriate changes that have happened. Very little in terms of constructive criticism. In other words, I hear almost not, like, almost all the old people sound old, jaded, burned out, and that they're done, rather than that they have any ideas at all about how to do, think, transform.
Not only that they're done, but that it's not their fault that they're done.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, coming to the Bay and being in an anarchist subculture for the first time, I do think I immediately saw a lot of things I didn't like. And it's pretty easy to make fun of it. It's very easy to make fun of it. And we saw a lot of it on that thread, and it's, you know, it's just a bunch of immature people. It's like high school. It's all hookup culture, sure. And then pretty much the other major line of criticism was, oh, you've just got this denunciative moralism of you're fucked up, you're this, you're that. Yeah, and I think those are relevant criticisms, but I don't see much beyond I met certain people that I don't like and they were jerks to me, therefore I'm done. And that's a criticism you can make about any kind of subculture.
Yeah.
And I don't see anything about what makes this specifically a problem with anarchism.
Yeah, I mean, the other direction to take this in, which, you know, obviously I'm very uncomfortable with, one of the things you do see at the long haul is that there are some older than me people who sort of feel, who vibe a bit more of the 60s than they do of the 80s, who come around the long haul, and they don't necessarily help that much, but to the extent to which they do help out and they're present and they're engaged, they're in it for the movement.
Mm.
And you know, what they mean is the same thing that everyone else means when they sort of evoke some sort of larger quasi-real, quasi-spiritual thing that actually looks like a conversation about liberating human beings from the shackles that we've created for ourselves. And so on the one hand, you know, your heart goes out to these people because it sure would be great if that movement existed. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I guess if it were to exist, would it be born in spaces like the long haul? Would it be born in the relationships that we call the anarchist milieu? And this is the central question of today, because I think a lot of people, you know, are beginning to reject this idea that anything liberatory is going to grow out of radical spaces, and that instead that basically the role of radicals is to sort of shut up and get out of the way so that the proletariat or, you know, some magic or people of color in urban settings do the work.
Mm-hmm.
And this is sort of talked about in two different ways that I think are interesting in anarchist texts. You know, on the one hand, we have nihilist communism and sort of their provocation about the pro-revolutionary, which, you know, more or less is like the fan of revolution.
The cheerleader.
The cheerleader. And then on the other hand, we have Bob Black in the 80s wrote this piece that basically says the biggest problem with anarchism is anarchists, which really speaks to the same problem.
Mm-hmm. I'm actually not familiar with that piece.
So. Yeah, well, we should talk about it in another episode.
Okay, sure. Yeah, I think to me, the frustration was with the thread. I mean, again, I thought there was a lot of good in the thread and a lot of interesting things, but the theme that kept coming up was this sort of vindictive anarchists just shouldn't even be hanging out with each other at all. And so I was talking a little bit with Squee about this, and he was pointing out a lot of people have this idea that anarchists should separate and almost, you know, disperse ourselves like so many dandelion seeds and then just inject ourselves into various social movements, not so much as anarchists speaking the gospel of anarchism, but rather as, you know, these highly energetic people who are going to agitate and enhance whatever the conflictuality of these different social movements. And I still find it hard to understand the idea that anarchists shouldn't be talking to each other, sharing ideas, and supporting each other's projects. And I don't think that has to happen with the social dynamics of a subculture that everyone likes to make fun of and is very easy to make fun of. It seems to me that there's a conflation with the idea of just anarchists spending any time with each other at all in these particular social dynamics.
Yeah, I mean, of course, the conclusion of this is going to be some sort of like, it doesn't have to be all or nothing. My inner Midwesterner is coming out, but
I thought it was actually a mockery of my Midwesternness.
Fair enough. But with that said, this is actually a pretty serious problem. Meaning, in another context, I just had someone who I would call like a tacoonist mm-hmm. say that the problem is hanging out with anarchists. Full stop.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, sort of their movement, which is very explicit on this point, which is abandon the milieu and do the good work sort of outside of the milieu. But, you know, what's absolutely absurd about this construction is that perhaps that is true in the context of France, mm-hmm. that has very different conditions, mm-hmm. has a very different people's relationship to politics is very different in France than it is in the U.S. When you bring a group of people who are concerned about political issues and do not want to become reformists, do not want to become involved in real politique, you have the first problem you have to face is the fact that what do you do in your spare time? What do you do when you're not saving the world? And you know the answer that sort of punk rock really provided, but that in general you see in radical politics, is you associate with each other. And especially in big urban centers, there's going to be other people who are sort of similar to you. And so this idea that you sort of should abandon the milieu on the one hand is absurd because it doesn't solve the answer to that question, except that it does, which is what we see in the sort of three or four big urban centers that have the sort of leave the milieu behind. What you actually have are smaller milieus. Mm-hmm. You actually have people who basically appear to be francophiles, who dress in nice clothing, but normal, who associate with each other rather than associate with the menagerie that is the anarchist milieu. And so you end up having sort of the weakness of not actually having all that many people who understand what the hell you're doing. And what you do instead is you create a smaller, more attenuated milieu of people who sort of speak an incredibly coded language.
And maybe one that's a small milieu that's more project oriented than socially oriented, would you say, or not even?
It would be nice to say that that's the case. I mean, Woodbine, which is this project in New York City, would definitely, from what I can tell at a distance, seems to be much more project focused, much more like they have sort of a plan, and it's clear that they're working towards that plan. None of the other sort of spaces or projects that I've heard of in North America appear to be as coherent as New York is, but here in the local area, it seems very social. Mm-hmm.
So a grievance that I didn't so much see coming up in the comment thread with the topic of the week was what I would call the deeper critique of the subculture beyond just making fun of them for acting a certain way. And that's, I guess, it's come for me coming on the heels of just immediately having read Ron Sokolsky's Mutual Acquiescence piece, or Breaking Loose, it's called. Mm-hmm. And to me, the deeper critique of the subculture is the mutual acquiescence, which I would say is rampant. And it's this validation of, yes, I'm an anarchist, yes, I'm a radical, and wanting to look in the mirror and say that to oneself and then have one's friends reflect that as well. And it means, I would say, at least in the Bay Area, that being anarchist means being seen, at the protests and the parties, regardless of what kind of actual political potency they have. It's a certain sexual orientation, usually being polyamorous or queer. It's certain social mores and speaking a certain vernacular, saying all the right buzzwords, and then having an income that's predicated either on some sort of criminality that makes one edgy or some sort of moral job of being in an NGO and having basically saying, okay, we do all these things, therefore we're anarchists, therefore I'm in this group. And it ends up being, you know, just, it feels nice. It feels nice to be around people who are validating you. And you sort of lose, I think, the wider angle of what am I actually doing? And so to me, that's the deeper critique. And I'm wondering if we could just nod back to episode one, is maybe a possible way out of this mutual acquiescence or a possible way out of the critiques of the subculture to have those more projectual relationships?
Well, of course, that's my personal ideal. And I feel like that ideal was infectious when, not to get Marxist for a little bit, but I probably would say that there's an argument that most of the points that you're talking about are the result of the fact that people don't have time for full relationships with one another. That instead, our relationships, whether they're radical or not, are fit in the cracks between racing from one part-time job to another part-time job. Mm-hmm. They're racing from running from a part-time job to a protest, to, you know, prisoner writing, to whatever it is. And that basically, like, as living in the Bay Area in particular, as it's become more difficult just on the logistical, like, money for rent, sort of level, just the amount of time that people have to care for one another is drastically decreased. Mm-hmm. And it was, and perhaps in the past, caring for one another was a value mm-hmm. that people shared and understood each other on. But I wouldn't say that that's a value that I experience in radical politics today. By and large, people are spend a lot of time sort of naming others and hating them mm-hmm. because of whatever name they've come up with.
Mm-hmm. Nihilist.
Yeah, something like that.
Okay.
I think that's good. So the format of this brilliant podcast is that every week we talk a little bit about the news. We try to do it in a sort of non-topical way. We try to talk about the ideas behind the news. And then each week we have a theme. This week the theme is a little challenging because it's definitely a topic that I want to talk about, but it's not exactly, there isn't necessarily like a stance on it. In other words, the last two episodes were clearly four positions. So projectuality, four. Imagination, four. But this week we're going to talk about principles, and specifically anarchist principles. What do they mean? What do they look like? And so so we're going to talk sort of about the classic understanding of anarchist principles and the way in which even today a lot of people, when they're introduced to anarchist ideas, are introduced to anarchist principles as if they are fixed positions. And then we're going to talk a little bit about what future or what less fixed positions look like. And so the texts we're going to talk about mostly are going to be a text from Laurent Jarrac, Instead of a Meeting, by Someone Too Irritated to Sit Through Another One. And Lawrence actually does a pretty good job of establishing a sort of standard position. And then the other piece that we're going to talk at least a little bit about is a piece that I wrote called Locating an Indigenous Anarchism.
So I do think that Lawrence's piece is a good response to the way that I think a lot of these classical anarchist values get reinterpreted today in what might be called a kind of decadent or deteriorated way. And so he lays out solidarity, mutual aid, direct action, voluntary association. And I really liked the fact that he was highlighting that direct action is frequently misinterpreted, that mutual aid is frequently misinterpreted. And for direct action, I usually think of Voltairine de Cleyre, and her piece was actually one of the first explicitly anarchist pieces of literature that I encountered, where she contrasts it very diametrically with political action. So it's direct action if you're acting without mediation, whereas we're so used to the mediated activity that we don't even notice a lot of the time. And I'm not sure where you want to go with this, because I was going to do a whole thing about how I see these principles reinterpreted in this milieu today.
Mm-hmm. In other words, you're just going to criticize the the way in which people play it out.
While still saying this is anarchism, this is direct action, this, mm-hmm. you know, that sort of thing. So, for instance, here, there, maybe 4 years ago or something, there was this whole riots work slogan. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so I think for many people, the riot seems like clearly direct action. I'm breaking the law. I'm destroying things with my hands. I'm being visible. This feels like an unmediated activity. But then you see the kind of insidiousness with the actual riots work understanding, which is that rioting leads to desirable legal social reform. Mm-hmm. And Lawrence does a really good bit where he points out breaking things can be examples of direct action. I'm quoting Lawrence here. Mm-hmm. Breaking things can be examples of direct action, but the intention behind these acts are what is important, not the acts themselves. Direct action has nothing to do with pressuring any part of a government to alter a policy. But right now we have this understanding of the riot as direct action that leads to possibly desirable police-related social reforms. And so you can, I think there's a lot of cases in how this has been sort of decadently interpreted.
Well, actually, let's talk about this a little bit more, because this is actually, this piece really helped clarify some ideas that I had when it was written that has led me to sort of, in general, not call myself a post-left anarchist anymore.
Okay.
And that's because this quote that you just read is actually a fantastic quote, because it does speak to the heart of post-left anarchy, in my opinion, which is intention.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, when I read that piece, I sort of examined this idea about intention, and I found myself not agreeing with Lawrence here at all. Not that I agree about the breaking windows being direct action, but the idea that one would parse activity in such a way as to sort of determine whether the activity was sort of...
like if you're thinking the right anarchist things.
Exactly.
Right.
And this actually runs through a lot of the post-left anarchist writing, that basically we could be doing the same thing on the streets or in our daily life, and the intention matters to the post-left anarchist.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure it does.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not even going to go down this because it's just a philosophy rabbit hole,
but
to briefly say, I have huge problems with the idea of intentionality. I think it's a completely fraught concept. The fact that there are moral systems predicated on intentionality, I think it's terrible. But yes, because it basically means I did the same thing as you, but when I went home and got into bed, I was thinking the right things, and I was thinking about how dumb you were while you were doing those things, even though I was doing it. And that ends up being a pretty weird position.
What it actually ends up being, the position of what does post-left anarchist practice look like, and you just described what post-left anarchist practice should look like, is that we went to the same event, and I came home and realized how stupid you were.
Mm-hmm.
And so it ends up being a critical perspective, which, you know, is fair enough. It's not like those things shouldn't be criticized. It's not like I disagree with, in general, what those criticisms are going to be. But I'm just not sure the criticism itself is necessarily a particularly interesting form of life.
Mm-hmm.
Or to put it a little differently, I love Lawrence for the way in which he describes some definitions in ways that I pretty much can accept.
Mm-hmm.
And then I move on. And what ends up happening, and what ends up being a lot of the fights that you see both online and in general with post-left anarchists, is that post-left anarchism has to fight for those definitions. And those are not fights that I think are particularly good uses of time. But I'm, in general, comfortable using the definitions and moving on.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, finish talking through your thoughts, because probably the most important one for Lawrence and for a lot of other post-life anarchists actually isn't direct action, which I just think that they're right about what the definition should be,
mm-hmm.
and most people in the way they use it are wrong. Full stop. But the most important post-left traditional anarchist principle is voluntary association.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because it basically says, leave me alone.
Or, I'm free to be an island if I want to be.
Mm-hmm.
And I can dissociate from everything as soon as I think that the people around me are being dumb.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I don't even think we ran through the list. Of course, the classical values we're talking about are solidarity, mutual aid, direct action, and voluntary association, if that wasn't clear. And then, yeah, the way that I think mutual aid, unfortunately, again, is becoming this decadent thing, is that it means, in many modern American subcultures, deference to those who are perceived as less privileged. And the voluntary association becomes a moral obligation to participate in certain social struggles from a kind of secondary observer position who, you know, somehow I'm going to bring the radicalism to what, of course, is going to be a large-scale and then almost inherently liberal activity. And so then this watch phrase of meeting people where they're at just means a perpetual deference to liberalism.
Yeah, I mean, again, I think that this is, I agree with you. I feel like this probably is the case anytime you tie your political perspective down to a set of terms, mm-hmm. is that you basically provide this type of entryism. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And then the terms mutate into prayers that, so long as we're saying them to ourselves, then anything that we do is blessed.
Yeah.
I'm doing mutual aid. And it could be charity.
Five completely indiscernible minutes pass, and then we're here.
It's a critique of power politics, and so if you're not basically willing to make the sort of real politique types of decisions, so you're not going to, you know, join the school board, you basically limit yourself to this magical place called the streets is the only place in which you can express political power. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, just to say it, I have no idea why people believe that the streets is actually a place where political power resides.
There it is.
I mean, riots work at what?
Reform, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I think it's demonstrably true that they do. And I think you can go back years and years and years and see how that happened. I mean, you could argue the whole civil rights, the huge thrust of the civil rights movement was riots work. Yeah, they keep fucking rioting and the laws will change.
And at the end of the day, anarchists have a plausible deniability around that part of it because they don't do any of the work around that part of it. In other words, you know, the anarchist position is sort of a puritanical position that says, as long as I'm only doing the part of the work that is that doesn't touch all the grossness of making a law, mm-hmm. or of changing city council's mind or whatever, as long as I don't get involved in those aspects, the fact that riots do work and I helped provide the fuel for the people who do that work, I have plausible deniability that I have anything to do with it.
I didn't want them to take it down the Reform Avenue.
Right.
Yeah.
And this is because of what I feel like is a pretty disconnected from reality political perspective that perhaps we can point to Lenin as being the author of this, but perhaps we can talk about the French Revolution in this context and say that, you know, pitchforks and torches on the street led to the beheading of a lot of bad people 250 years ago. Why not now? And we know why not now. The powers that be have a sophisticated analysis of what's happening that the riots work perspective is not. I guess it's just very off topic from the idea of anarchist principles, but I do feel like anarchist principles have sort of led us to this particular conclusion, this sort of fetishist revolutionist idea that is maybe worth mentioning, but perhaps we shouldn't dwell on it.
I don't feel like it's deviating too far from the thing. So you were talking about how you feel that new anarchist principles have emerged.
Yeah. Well, there's a couple ways to talk about this. I mean, I think more broadly, I was thinking about this exactly in the way in which Lawrence lists these sort of traditional principles. I think that there are some traditional principles that sort of should be added to the list in the 21st century. Mm-hmm. One of which I would add would be transparency.
Yeah. Which I think is a very democratic principle.
Sure. But it also addresses the First International critique, mm-hmm. that Bakunin, by not being transparent, basically, and being for sort of the secret society, was not anarchistic. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's sort of the political historical motivation for why transparency is embraced. But yeah, absolutely, democracy argues for the same point.
Yeah.
And it's unclear in modern anarchist practice whether or not transparency actually happens, because the strongest argument against transparency in most anarchist circles is quote unquote security culture.
Right.
And so it turns out that security culture perhaps is another anarchist principle that is directly.
Yeah, that's a really good new one that has emerged. And closely related to that is, as I was thinking of new ones that have emerged, is what I would call fetishization of process. And certainly the way that consensus has caught on in anarchist circles, this idea that I think, although not often articulated in these terms, is people are fallible. Our socialization makes us extremely fallible. The way to escape the crappy things about us is to have the right process. And if we can just get the process right, then it means that everyone's voice has been heard. No one can be that fucked up to each other. And you see that, of course, with decision-making through consensus, and then also the infamous accountability process.
I was actually going to mention that as what I would say is a modern principle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the accountability process, which, as far as I've seen, has not actually manifested on Earth. But this idea of, if we can just work on our shit enough, if we can find the right way to air all the grievances, then things will be good.
Yeah, just to speak in defense of accountability, there's a way in which accountability could be defined as if you have enough meetings, everybody feels shitty, and that's accountability. Which I think there's something fair about that. Like one of the things that is actually true about the modern radical is that we are still alienated. We are still removed from actual relationships with one another.
Definitely. Yeah.
And the ideal accountability session means that we now all of a sudden are in each other's lives, in each other's shit. I think a lot of people, when they talk about like when radicals say that they're going to move to the country and it's going to solve all their problems once they live in rural life, why many people sort of resist that is because they perceive the small town as being a place of horror and of being trapped, rather than a place that actually truly frees one from the social ties that they might despise from the city. Mm-hmm. I mention this mostly because the best examples I've ever heard of sort of accountability processes have been in towns like Santa Cruz, where there's a lot of people who've known each other for a very long time who sort of represent the core of what these processes look like and mean. And usually the processes are about people who are much more short timers, and it ends up being a way in which the old timers sort of sit in meetings with one another and feel each other out and have relationships with each other. Mm-hmm. And the new people who perhaps are even at the heart of the controversy spin themselves out and leave.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, I think my tone in talking about this is obviously very cynical, jaded, and I'm kind of being a sneery, ha ha ha, everything sucks. And I don't like to occupy that space too much. And so what I will say is that, yes, I think the aim and the desire motivating this is a good one. It is the recognition of alienation and the recognition that just because I have this cool analysis and theory that answers a lot of questions doesn't mean that I'm necessarily any more able to have real relationships with people. The point of my poking fun here is just to say that I think there's this intellectualization that if only we have the process, we can make up for the fact that we're still these alienated, fucked up people, which I'm skeptical of.
Yeah, I think that there is a certain type of person who that vocabulary really works for, and they hammer the hell out of it and sort of chase everybody else out of the room.
Mm-hmm. The vocabulary of the
process. Yeah.
I mean, like, sure. The just born bureaucrat.
Yeah, just this last weekend, we had a pretty contentious meeting at the Long Hall, which is a collective, but it's a collective that has never sort of used collective methodology or process. Mm-hmm. And there's this woman who is sort of like not socially part of the Long Hall, but their group focuses a lot on how to do good process. Mm-hmm. Their group is a co-housing group, and so they focus a lot on...
NPC. Like,
well, they focus actually a lot on how are we going to live together if we're strangers and there's a bunch of money on the line. Mm. So there's a way in which the process focus makes some sense to them because it's real in a way that a lot of radical politics is not real. But when she started to try to sort of nail the consensus down, especially using lots of like affirmations as sort of the talking filler.
And whatnot. I honor your perspective.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Hey, you know, I think that before we go on, we really should honor the fact that blah, blah, blah said blah, blah, blah. Uh-huh. I mean, I consider all of that to be total bullshit. I mean,
I think it's more honest to say your perspective will always be incomprehensible to me, but that's my approach.
Yeah,
that's I will never know what it's like to think the things you're thinking, but...
But mostly it's funny to watch that perspective in a room that's incredibly informal, because the flip side of this, again, just to be a little contrary, is to say that I actually think that informal consensus is perhaps even more toxic than process-focused consensus, because, in general, informal consensus tends towards a type of popularity contest, tends towards... Absolutely.
Yeah. And... I know we won't get into it in this episode, but I know that you and some others have arrived at a different sort of collective decision-making process, and maybe that would be interesting to talk about on the show at some time.
Yeah, I mean, for sure, it's going to make sense to be a theme, to just talk about counterexamples.
Sure.
I think that one of the problems about even having that conversation is that you're making these assumptions about what the future of working with other people is going to look like that are really challenging. Because one of the things, for instance, that I've seen a lot in radical circles is that, in general, as soon as conflict comes up, people just bail.
Yeah, definitely.
And so how do you come up with a different system or even think about this problem when basically you're trying to catch fish with your hands? Mm-hmm. And
are you saying I'm acting as if the system is widely applicable?
No, I'm just saying that the problem... of how to do decision making and how to even think about, like, if the rationale for a process like consensus is so that we can, you know, make decisions together, but the cultural transformation that's happened since consensus sort of came into radicals' lives in the 80s, the radical transformation is that conflict means pull the parachute cord and get the hell out of there. It almost becomes irrelevant.
Mm-hmm.
And that basically really what you're talking about is the people who stick around tend towards certain types, many of whom you could just call stubborn. And so perhaps you can't actually make very many decisions when you're just dealing with a bunch of stubborn people.
Sure.
And you really are having a conversation about how can we stay the hell out of each other's way? Mm-hmm. Which in the context of long haul, which is the conflict I'm thinking about a lot right now, is absolutely what's happening. Well, yeah, so the pivot here is to talk a little bit about this article that I wrote a long time ago, perhaps as long as 10 years ago, called Locating in Indigenous Anarchism. And in it, I sort of state some first principles. So we're talking about anarchist principles, and I'm describing in this article something that I'm calling Indigenous Anarchism, which I'm distinguishing from the old kind of anarchism that, you know, is from Europe, perhaps in the U.S. context, involved immigration, perhaps in the American context, looks a lot more like Easy Rider than it does like the Internationale. So the proposition here is that perhaps there's an anarchism that grew in this soil and that has a really different tenor, that perhaps looks land-based, that perhaps looks quote-unquote indigenous. There's a nice piece that part of it that I really like that, and I'll just quote here.
Do you want to get the background on what the piece is?
Oh, right. Yeah. So the piece was written for Green Anarchy magazine, I guess in the middle part of their run. It was an entire issue on indigenous issues, which I actually felt ended up not being that strong, largely because they did a lot of reprints and, you know, they didn't have the resources to sort of perhaps do the to do what I would do. I mean, one of the goals of Black Seed, which is a paper that I work on that is attempting to sort of maintain the spirit of what Green Anarchy did, is that I've really committed in Black Seed to having there be strong indigenous voices in every issue, and really to take the perspective that anarchism has a lot to learn from real living people who are probably indigenous, but rather than sort of the attitude that I felt like Green Anarchy took a lot, which was a sort of, we already know what the answers are, mm-hmm. And we're looking for other people to sort of confirm, mm-hmm. Especially if they're brown people, then you know.
You felt like there was some mascot.
Absolutely, uh-huh. Absolutely. But I mean, again, the criticism, it's not, the point isn't a criticism, the point is that their resources, mm-hmm. they just didn't have much in the way of resources, nor interest in pursuing this particular line of thought. Mm-hmm. So I have more resources in this vein, and I'm much more interested in pursuing this line of thought. And it's actually one of the aspects of Black Seed that sort of depressed me that people haven't really caught on with, which is this idea that instead of sort of telling the world what it is, that we are sort of asking the world, what is it? Mm-hmm. Anyway, so the part that I was going to read, I guess it's not really a quote, but it's just this idea that most of the indigenous anarchists that I've met have been natives because there are so few teachers of any of these sort of values in Western life. Mm. And I feel like, you know, again, like in the past, I would have engaged in a lot of criticism about how stupid Whitey is, but I think the more difficult problem is the fact that Whitey has very few teachers, and pursuing some of the other topics we've talked about during this episode, most people, first of all, they run away rather than sit down and sort of listen and learn, and second of all, there's a sort of dismissive attitude towards the slowness that any of these sort of perspectives would require. That is pretty much, it's the opposite of the internet, and the opposite of the internet is not searchable. So just to wrap up my sort of speechifying here for a second, in the article, I do talk about some principles. One of them is that everything is alive and that there are no objects. The second one is that memory is very important. The third one, that place is very important. Fourth one, that an extended family is central to sort of understanding what the self is. The problem, of course, is that the term family in our context has so many burdens, yeah. that it's hard, yeah. to defend the language. But and then finally, self-determination and radical decentralization, which basically is the desire for people who are self-organized, whether by tradition, choice, or inclination, to decide how they want to live with each other. And so this has something to do with terminology. In other words, this is one of the reasons why in my practice today, I argue that calling yourself an anarchist, or sort of explicitly stating that you're in the family of those ideas, is important, because that's what self-determination looks like. And perhaps what I'm saying about our friends who are abandoning the milieu is that what they're really saying is that there is no self, and explicitly there is no self-determination possible.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's impossible not to immediately, for me, want to contrast the, or compare it maybe, mm-hmm. with the kinds of complaints that we saw about people saying the subculture sucks and I'm aging and I'm dropping out because, right, they felt that they were in a place that was dead emotionally and passionately, that there was no sort of memory, there was no subcultural memory of how to cope with conflict, there was no sense of place, mm-hmm. and a lot of people specifically said, oh, suddenly everyone was aging and dropping out and I didn't know where I was anymore, and there was no sense of family, there was a feeling that the relationships were shallow.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I mean, someone even, one, I think it might have been the first comment on the thread, was someone saying, like, we need places, and I think they were saying we need, the, you know, these sort of rural intentional community kind of places. And so, I mean, it's, I think it gives a certain bite to what you're writing immediately to see so many anarchists basically saying, yeah, we don't have these values, and that's why it sucks.
Yeah. And the hard thing is, it's not like an article that states the values clearly, which perhaps this does, is enough.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, for me, I would
it's
like
something.
Yeah, it's something, but perhaps to me, it's, you know, my thought is how have I fallen short and not fallen short of achieving some of these values myself? I mean, or perhaps it's a contrary conversation to the one of principles, because, you know, a lot of natives are going to agree with this list of principles. And if you look at their practice, it isn't going to look like this at all. It's going to look like how urban people have to live.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I would say that talking about everybody being alive and that there are no objects is a statement about time that I do not practice in my daily life.
Mm-hmm.
In my daily life, I have a full-time job and more. And then I have all these radical projects that I work on. And the patience to just stop when there's a moment of the real,
mm-hmm.
I don't have that patience. Mm-hmm. I drive right past it, just like everyone else does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. There was a particular line toward the, I think it's in the middle of the piece, that when I first read it, and I didn't know you at all, and at this time you were just this body of text in the Uncivilized Anthology,
mm-hmm.
and it made me love the piece, and it goes, I'm just going to quote it, "The question that anarchists of all stripes have to answer for themselves is whether they are capable of dealing with the consequences of other people living in ways they find reprehensible." And there are a lot of ways to parse this. You could say it's the difference between first and second wave anarchy.
Mm-hmm.
You could say it's the, you know, it's the difference between the Enlightenment anarchism and the indigenous anarchism. I mean, there are lots of ways you can talk about it, but it actually was really perfect for me in the way that I was radicalized, because I like to make the joke that I'm one of the only anarchists I know who was radicalized by David Hume. Or I am the only anarchist I know. I'm sorry. And, you know, so I read Nietzsche and Hume before I read any kind of people who call themselves anarchists. And then I went straight from that to reading a lot of leftist stuff. And the thing I could never deal with the leftism was, after reading those two thinkers who are so at odds with that, is these anarchists that I'm reading now, they want to write their views on the world. They mm-hmm. want the global view. There's the real and the good and the true, and it needs to be, you know, engulf the world. Yeah.
Yeah.
And even, you know, a lot of people who will say that they want to distance themselves from that Enlightenment perspective, well, still, one of the things I like to mess with people when they're sort of putting forth the utopic vision is, you know, what if the people on the other side of the hill are having sex in a way that you think is wrong?
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people who claim to be anti-Enlightenment, who claim to be anti-moralist, will say, yeah, I would go over there and stop them. You know, I would invade them.
Yeah. I mean, the example I hear a bit more often is, what if you know that your neighbors are beating their wife?
Okay. Yeah. That means it gets the same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because most people say, well, sex, who cares?
Oh, no, I don't think so. I mean, if,
yeah. Well, in lefty anarchist
yeah.
circles. As long as there's a condom involved.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's a serious question.
Well, I think we could wrap it up. We've actually, we're going a little long, actually.
Okay.
Or, unless you want to do a...
No, I just feel like I took up the end of it with my weird monologue.